another copy of William Lane Craig's On Guard, and I'd like to give it to somebody who can tell us, give us one of the arguments from last week. So we had the fine-tuning argument, and we had the moral argument last week. Is there anybody who'd like to give it a shot? We got one. I think, did you get a book last at the first time?
Not from the guessing, but you gave it to me the first day.
Okay. If nobody else wants to do it, I'll give you this copy as well. Is there anyone else who's interested, who thinks they can do it? I love it. You're getting a little apologetics library going here. Oh, we got one. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Okay, it's pretty close. I was looking for a little more. Anybody else? Do you think you could frame that as like a valid argument? Like, give me three premises. Or sorry, two premises and a conclusion. So one of them is objective, right and wrong, exists, or moral claims are objectively true or false. You can't remember. Okay. All right. Anybody else? I want to give it a try. Should we redo last week's and just, I think, yeah. Yes.
So without a God who would give us a certain set of moral values, we would not know right and wrong.
Okay.
Without like an objective right and wrong, we do know an objective right and wrong, therefore there is a God.
Okay. That's pretty good. Yeah. Let's give it up for him. There you go. All right. Well, welcome. It's good to see all of you. I'm really excited for tonight. Really, tonight's lesson is what we've been building towards this whole time here. We've been looking at reasons for thinking that God exists. We will look today at one of the most common reasons for thinking that God doesn't exist. One of the, I think, probably the strongest argument against the existence of God. We're going to look at that today. We're going to look at some what I think are great responses to that. And then we're going to look at an argument for the resurrection of Jesus. So that's what we're going to do today. I want to just quickly review what we've already done up to this point here. So for the first meeting, so 2 weeks ago, it would have been 3 weeks ago, we had our introduction and we did, what is apologetics, right? And we said apologetics is being able to give a defense of the Christian faith. We looked at how do we know that Christianity is true? Does anybody remember? How do we know that Christianity is true? Is it by arguments, evidence, reasons? No. How do we know that Christianity is true? It's by the self-authenticating witness of the Holy Spirit. That is, we know the truths of Christianity through the Holy Spirit. So the question then is, well, why do apologetics then? And that's because apologetics can help us build our confidence and trust in God. It can help us when we want to present the gospel to others, there often people will have things that are preventing them from being able to take seriously the gospel. And so this gives us an opportunity to deal with some of those things that are preventing them from giving the gospel an open hearing. And then three, this is an opportunity to worship God. And so we then went on and we looked at some arguments for theism. And the first one we looked at 3 weeks ago was, why did the universe begin? And this was the Kalam cosmological argument. And then last week we looked at the fine-tuning argument. And then we also looked at the moral argument. And so what we've learned up to this point is that an uncaused cause that is timeless and spaceless and an immaterial mind intentionally designed the universe and is morally good. And not just morally good, but is actually the foundation and grounding for all goodness. God is actually the standard of what goodness actually is. And so we've come to this conclusion here from these arguments. And there's so many other arguments we could look at. In fact, if you're interested in getting a little bit more of this, there's a really great Christian philosopher. His name is Alvin Plantinga. And Alvin Plantinga has an article that's available for free on the web. You can find it. And it's like 24 arguments for the existence of God. He just like goes after it. And he's one of the top philosophers of today, not just among Christian philosophers, but among all philosophers. He's like, I would say probably within the top 10 philosophers of the last 100 years or so. He's had a huge impact in philosophy, in academia, but he's also a Christian and has had a huge impact on contemporary Christianity as well. So definitely take a look at Alvin Plantinga and his work. All right, so what we're going to look at now is we're going to look at the problem of evil. And the problem of evil, we're going to look at two versions of it. One is called the logical problem of evil, and one of them is called the evidential problem of evil. We're going to look at those today. And then we've looked at some arguments for the existence of God. And these arguments get you at the existence of God, but how do we know that Christianity is true? Moreover, if a holy, good God exists, that God must be really unhappy with us because we do many things that would displease God. We're actually in serious trouble. In fact, C.S. Lewis in his book Mere Christianity says, if there does exist an absolute goodness, it must hate most of what we do. And so we find ourselves in serious trouble. And that leads us to the final thing we're going to look at today, and really what the whole point of all of this is. After the problem of evil and the logical problem of evil, we're going to look at an argument for the resurrection of Jesus. So that's what we're going to do today. We'll wrap this up. Let's go ahead and start by looking at the problem of evil. So this is a really, really well-known and ancient argument against theism. In fact, Epicurus, who's an ancient Greek philosopher from the 3rd century BC, he presents the argument this way. He says, if God is willing to prevent evil but not able, then he is not all-powerful. If he is able to prevent evil but not willing, then he's not good. If he is both willing and able, how can evil exist? And if he is neither able nor willing, well then why call him God? There's two different versions of this argument, and the first one we're going to look at is what's known as the logical problem of evil. So I'm going to lay it out for you, and then we're going to go through and we'll look at why it is that atheists hold these premises, and we're going to look at some objections here, actually really one objection. So the argument goes like this. It's logically impossible for God, and here we're understanding God as an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent being. It's impossible for God and suffering to both exist. Second premise. Suffering exists. So the conclusion then is God does not exist. So this is the argument. And again, we've talked about the structures of arguments. This is what's known as a valid argument, meaning the structure is excellent. If these premises are true, we're stuck with the conclusion whether we like it or not. What you can't do is say, oh, premise one and premise two, those are both true, but the conclusion is false. That's not going to work logically. And so if there's a problem with this argument, it's going to have to be a problem with at least one of those premises. So let's look at why is it that atheists hold this argument to be a good argument. And we're going to start with premise two. So the support for premise two goes like this. Why think suffering exists? Well, this is supported by our experience of suffering in the world. There are natural disasters. There are diseases, there are birth defects, there's genetic disorders, right? We've got a history that involves concentration camps and great injustices. There's racism, there's abuse, there's cruelty and theft, all sorts of instances of great suffering. I don't think we need to spend much time actually supporting premise two. I think we're all aware that suffering exists. So the real question is going to be premise one. Why think it's true that it's logically impossible for God and suffering to both exist? And here's the reasoning. So this is support for premise one. If God is omnipotent, then he would be able to prevent suffering. And if God was omniscient, then he would know about the suffering and would know how to prevent it. And if God was omnibenevolent, and don't worry, I'm going to define these in a moment. then he would want to prevent suffering. So what is omnipotence here? Well, that is to say that God is all-powerful. And when we say God is all-powerful or all-omnipotent, what we mean is God is able to do anything that is logically impossible. Logically possible. In fact, I remember when I was younger, the first argument I ever came across against the existence of God, I think I was in sixth or seventh grade, and someone said, "Oh, you believe that God exists. Well, you think God is omnipotent?" And I said, "Well, yeah, God's all-powerful." And this person said, "Well, could God make a rock too heavy for him to lift?" And that one stumped me for quite a while, right? Because if you say yes, that's a problem. And if you say no, he can't make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift, well, then you've got a problem as well. And so the issue here is we need to make sure that we get clear here. God can't do things that are logically impossible. In fact, God can't do things that go contrary to his very nature. So there are some limits on what God is able to do here. But it's limits on his because of his very nature, and it's limits based on logic. God can't do things that are he can't make a square circle, for example. Or he can't make the Pythagorean theorem false, for example. So God is all-powerful. And that means God's able to do anything that's logically possible. And is it logically possible for God to create a world where there's no evil and suffering? Yeah, of course. All right, next one. God is omniscient. God is all-knowing. God knows all true statements and does not believe any false statements. That's what it means to say that God is all-knowing. And if God's all-knowing, then God would know about the evil and the suffering and would know how to prevent it. And then finally, we have God is omnibenevolent. What this means is God is all good. That means God is morally perfect. And if God is morally perfect, well then, the argument goes, God would want to prevent suffering. And so, if there's a being that exists that has all these properties, the argument goes, then it's impossible for suffering and evil to exist. That's the logical problem of evil. And I want to give you the response to this. There's lots of ways that people have responded, but this gets right at the core of this argument. And here's the response. The objection is this. It's entirely possible that God has good reasons for permitting evil that we are simply unaware of. If it's merely possible that God has some reason for allowing evil and suffering that we don't know about, then the whole argument falls apart because the argument says it's impossible. There's no way God could exist and suffering could exist. And so if it's just possible, there's just some way it could be the case, the argument fails. And of course, we can think of examples where God maybe allows evil and suffering. For example, maybe it's better for there to be creatures that have free will, and free will requires the ability to do evil. Right? That's a possible way that things could be. And so this argument actually does not work, and it's accepted and understood by all contemporary philosophers today that the logical problem of evil doesn't work. In fact, let me go a little bit further here. We don't need to be able to give what's called a theodicy to show that the logical problem of evil fails. Now, what is a theodicy? A theodicy is an account of why God actually permits suffering in the world. That is, we don't have to be able to explain why God actually allows suffering. Maybe we know in some cases, but we don't have to even be able to do that. We don't need to give an explanation of God's reasons that is plausible or probable. All we need to be able to do is show that it is possible that there are such reasons. Why? Because this argument is making such a strong claim. It's saying it's logically impossible for God and suffering to exist. So if you can just show that it's possible, not even probable, just possible, the argument fails. And so we don't have to get into stories about free will and all these other sorts of things. We can just simply say, isn't it possible that God's got a good reason that we don't know about? Of course that's possible, which means that first premise fails. It's not true. And this is where contemporary philosophers are. Philosophy, I think, often gets a bad rap for never making any progress. There has been genuine progress made when it comes to the problem of evil. In fact, I'm going to give you two atheists. Well, one's an atheist, one's an agnostic, who both recognize that this argument fails. The first one, his name's J.L. Mackey. He actually proposed the modern version of this argument. And then years later came back and said this: the problem of evil does not, after all, show that the central doctrines of theism are logically inconsistent with one another. Yeah, it doesn't actually work. He argued that it did, and then later came back and said, I was wrong. It doesn't work. Paul Draper, who is an agnostic, here's what he says. Logical arguments from evil are a dying or dead breed. For all we know, even an omnipotent and omniscient being might be forced to allow evil for the sake of obtaining some important good. Our knowledge of goods and evils and the logical relations they bear to each other is much too limited to prove that this could not be the case. And so the logical problem of evil just doesn't work. But that's not the end of the story, because someone could come back and say, okay, fine, the logical problem doesn't work. It's not impossible for God and evil to exist. But they might say, but the existence of evil and suffering makes it improbable that God exists. And that leads us to our second argument. This is going to be called the evidential problem of evil. And here's how it goes. If God exists, then there are no instances of pointless evil. And I'll explain what pointless evil is in just a moment. But there are instances of pointless evil. Therefore, the conclusion goes, God does not, in fact, exist. All right. Let's look at some support here for these premises. So the first premise says, if God exists and there's no instances of pointless evil, what is pointless evil? Well, this is intense suffering that God could have prevented without losing some greater good. That is, it's suffering that doesn't need to have happened for God to accomplish his purposes. So this is going to be the first argument here. And the atheist is going to say, we experience pointless evil and suffering all the time. Right? Think about floods and famines and children having terrible diseases and people, you know, our friends losing jobs and all sorts of things like that. We experience this all the time. In fact, William Rowe, who presents this argument, he says, you know, like, just think about a horrible forest fire where a deer is caught in this fire but doesn't die and is able to get out of the fire, but then over a week or so lies dying in a field, suffering, intense agony and pain. The fire wasn't enough to kill the deer in the moment, but that deer suffered over time. William Rowe says, what's the point of the evil and the suffering there? It seems like we don't see one. So this is what we mean by pointless evil. And the second premise is supported by saying, we see no point served by the many instances of suffering. There are many times where there's suffering and there's just no point to it. God's purposes aren't served. There's no greater good that comes about through this suffering occurring, like the deer suffering. What greater good could possibly have come from allowing that to happen? Okay, so this is the argument. This is the evidential problem of evil. And it says that it's unlikely that God exists given the existence of evil and suffering. All right, let's look at some responses to this. And I've got quite a few here. So the first objection I think we should raise against this argument is to say, well, why think that if there were a point to some instance of evil and suffering, why think we would be in a position to see it? We're finite creatures. We're limited in our understanding. Why think if there were some point to the suffering, we would actually be able to see it? And so to say, well, I don't see any point, doesn't mean that there isn't a point, because I'm not in a position where I should be able to see it if it's there. Let me give you an illustration. Suppose you go to the circus and a friend of yours who knows you were there and hears that you were sitting up in the bleachers watching the circus says, hey, were there elephants there? And you say, yeah, I watched the elephants. They did all sorts of things in the circus. And they say to you, did you see any fleas on the elephants? And you say, no, I didn't see any fleas. Should your friend conclude that the elephants had no fleas? No. Because if you're up in the bleachers, you're not close enough to be able to see a flea that would be on an elephant. You're not in the position to be able to know whether the elephant has fleas or not. And the argument here is we're in the same position as the person in the bleachers watching the elephants. If God has a point, if there's a point to suffering and evil, we're not in a position to be able to see it all the time. So just because we're not able to explain why there's evil or suffering in a particular instance doesn't mean that there is no point to it. Second objection here. We actually have really good reason to believe that God exists. And this gives us good reason to think that there are no instances of pointless evil. These last two sessions, we've seen some really good arguments for believing that God exists. So if we've got good reason to believe that God exists, then we have good reason to think that there is, in fact, no pointless evil. Let me show you how that argument would go. The theist who's confident that God exists could give the following argument. If God exists, then there are no instances of pointless evil. That's just the same first premise that the evidential argument from evil used. Identical, right? So they accept that premise. We accept that premise. But our second premise says God exists. And we have good reason to think that that's true. We just looked at a bunch of arguments for the existence of God. And so conclusion, therefore there are no instances of pointless evil. This is a valid argument too. The structure is excellent. And so what we're faced with then is really the question, what are you more confident in? That God exists or that there's instances of pointless evil? And I think we should be much more confident that God exists. All right, so that's the second objection of this argument. Third objection, the existence of evil is actually evidence for the existence of God. That is, the existence of evil is actually evidence for the existence of God. How can anything actually be evil on atheism? I get it, we don't like suffering. But that doesn't mean that suffering is evil if God doesn't exist. Right? But we recognize pointless suffering is a bad thing. How could anything be bad apart from God to actually ground things being evil or good? Let me give you a really great quote that comes from Alvin Plantinga here. Here's what he says. But could there really be any such thing as horrifying wickedness if atheism were true? I don't see how. There can be such a thing only if there's a way rational creatures are supposed to live. But atheism cannot make room for that. That requires a divine lawgiver, one whose very nature is to abhor wickedness. Accordingly, if there is really such a thing as horrifying wickedness, then you have a powerful theistic argument from evil. That is, our moral argument for the existence of God gives us good reason to think that God exists. If you think there really is such a thing as objective evil, then that means that there's really a ground for that, and that is God. And, oh, all right. I've come to the end of my objections here. What I want to do now is I want to show you a short video clip that comes from William Lane Craig's website that's going to look at the problem of evil here, and then we'll get back and we'll discuss it.
In part one, we looked at the logical version of the problem of suffering and evil. This argument attempts to show that since suffering and evil exist, it is logically impossible for God to exist. And we explained why even atheist philosophers admit that this argument fails. But wait! It may still be argued that while it's logically possible that God and suffering both exist, it's far from likely. There's just so much pointless suffering, it seems improbable that God could have good reasons for permitting it. This is the probability version of the problem. Suffering provides empirical evidence that God's existence is, not impossible, just highly unlikely. Is this a good argument? Consider three points. First, we are not in a position to say with any confidence that God probably lacks reasons for allowing the suffering in the world. The problem is that we're limited in space and time, and in intelligence and insight. God, on the other hand, sees every detail of history from beginning to end and orders it through people's free decisions and actions. In order to achieve his purposes, God may have to allow a great deal of suffering along the way. Suffering which appears pointless within our limited scope of understanding may be seen to have been justly permitted by God within his wider framework. Sometimes, what we experience makes no sense until we gain a wider perspective and see the big picture designed by the Creator. Here's the second point. Relative to the full scope of the evidence, God's existence may well be probable. You see, probabilities are always relative to background information. For example, if we consider only how much this man weighs, we would say it's highly improbable that he's a world-class athlete. But when we're willing to consider new information, that he's a professional sumo wrestler and a world champion, we quickly revise our view. In the same way, when the atheist claims that God's existence is improbable, we should ask, improbable relative to what background information? If we consider only the suffering in the world, then God's existence may very well appear to be improbable. But if we're willing to look at the full scope of background information, to take into account the powerful arguments for God's existence, we may come to a very different conclusion. The third point is, Christianity entails doctrines that increase the probability of the coexistence of God and suffering. Consider four of these. First, the chief purpose of life is not happiness. People often assume that if God exists, his role is to create a comfortable environment for his human pets. They think the ultimate goal of our lives on earth is happiness, and therefore, God is obligated to keep us happy. However, Christianity presents a radically different view, that the purpose of life is to know God. This alone brings true, lasting fulfillment. Suffering can bring about a deeper, more intimate knowledge of God, either on the part of the one who is suffering or those around him. The whole point of human history is that God, having given us free will, is drawing as many people as he can into his unending kingdom. Suffering is one of the ways God can draw people freely to himself. In fact, countries that have endured the most hardship often show the highest growth rates for Christianity.
God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our consciences, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world.
Second, mankind is in a state of rebellion against God and his purpose. Terrible human evils are testimony to man's depravity, a consequence of his alienation from God. The Christian isn't surprised at moral evil in the world. On the contrary, he expects it. The third doctrine states that God's purpose is not restricted to this life, but spills over beyond the grave into eternal life. This world is just the beginning, the entryway to an unimaginable, never-ending life beyond death's door. Paul, who wrote much of the New Testament, underwent afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, hunger. Yet he wrote, "We do not lose heart, for this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Because we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." Paul understood that life on earth, and whatever suffering it holds for each of us, is temporary. Our pain will not endure forever, but our lives with God will. Paul was not belittling the plight of those who suffer horribly in this life. Indeed, he was one of them. But he saw that those sufferings will be overwhelmed forever by the ocean of joy that God will give to those who will freely receive it. And the fourth doctrine is this: The knowledge of God is an incomparable good. Knowing God is the ultimate fulfillment of human existence, an infinite good. Thus, the person who knows God, no matter how much he has suffered, can still say, God is good to me. So, if Christianity is true, it's not at all improbable that suffering and evil should exist. In summary, for all these reasons, the probability version of the problem of evil is no more successful than the logical version. As a purely intellectual problem, then, the problem of evil does not disprove God's existence. But even if those intellectual arguments fail, the emotional problem of suffering and evil remains very powerful. If you have suffered deeply, or if you've watched someone you love go through intense pain, you may be thinking, so what if God exists? Why would I want to respond to him or worship him? I feel cold and empty and want nothing to do with him. You're not alone. God knows your name. He knows who you are and what you're going through. God promises to be with you through your suffering. He can give you the strength to endure. Jesus Christ also suffered. Although he was innocent, he was tortured and sentenced to death. His suffering had a purpose: to provide you and me with a life-giving connection to God. Not only does God exist, but he loves you. He seeks after you. He offers you hope. And in time, he will make all things new.
He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.
All right. I just want to remind you that I do have on those handouts links to all of these videos here and others. And so if you want to use these to share this with others, or if you want to watch these again, those are available to you. What I want to do is I want to give you just about a minute or so to get back together with the people at your table. What do you think about what we've just talked about here? What questions do you have? What worries do you have? What are your thoughts on this? Take a minute or two, talk together, and then we'll talk together. Go for it. Okay, I apologize for cutting it short here. Let's go ahead and get back together. Before we move on and look at an argument for the existence, or not for the existence, for the resurrection of Jesus, anybody, any questions or comments or worries, anything that any of that brought up for you? No? Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and let's move on and look at an argument for the resurrection of Jesus. So up to this point, we've seen we have really good reason to believe that God exists. And in fact, arguments that God doesn't exist turn out to be really weak. They're really not good arguments. That doesn't mean they're not worth considering, but there really aren't good arguments. And so what I want to do now is look at an argument for the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus made many outrageous claims about himself. He claimed to be the unique Son of God. He claimed that he was the Messiah. He claimed that he was the Son of Man who would be given dominion and glory. In fact, the only dominion and glory that belongs to God alone. And Jesus claimed these for himself. And so if Jesus actually rose from the dead, that gives great weight to the claims that he made. And so we want to look then at some reasons for thinking that Jesus rose from the dead. So here's going to be our approach. We're going to look at three historical facts that are agreed upon nearly unanimously by New Testament scholars and historians. And we're going to see that the best explanation for these facts is Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And one thing I want to say here, I'm going to be going through this pretty quickly. You don't have to take my word for any of this. In fact, I really strongly encourage you to explore this on your own. There's so many great resources out there. It's really grown my faith quite a bit, looking into this and just being continuously amazed at how good the evidence is for the resurrection of Jesus. So here's the argument. I'm going to give it to you, and then we'll work through the argument and look at support for each of the premises, just as we've done for the other arguments. So first premise of the argument, there are three widely accepted historical facts that need an explanation. So what are these widely accepted historical facts? The first one is the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. The second is going to be the appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And third is going to be the disciples' belief that Jesus rose from the dead. All three of these are widely accepted by historians and scholars who study this. And so the question then is, well, what's the best explanation of these facts? And that's where the second premise comes in. The best explanation of these facts is that Jesus was raised from the dead by God. And so the conclusion then is that Jesus was raised from the dead by God. So this is our argument. And what I want to do is I want to get into each of these premises a bit more. And I want to start with looking at support for that first premise, which says that there are three widely accepted historical facts. Why is it that New Testament historians and scholars accept these three facts? Well, we have to ask, how is it that historians establish facts about the past? And here's what they do. The first thing they do is they collect sources about the event, and they prioritize, they give greater weight to those sources that are earlier, closer to the event in time, and to those that are independent. That is, they don't rely on each other, or they don't all rely on a single source. So that's the first thing they do. Then once they've gathered those documents, then they evaluate specific events that are recorded in those documents, and they use several criteria. So one will be historical fit. How well does this fit with what we already know to be the case? They'll look at things like embarrassment. Are there elements in here that would be embarrassing to the people who would have written this down, that it would have been better for them, or they would have preferred to remove those things? If there's embarrassing elements, that indicates this person is really telling the truth about this. Dissimilarity. Are there elements that are different in these different accounts that we are looking at? Coherence is going to be another one. Do they actually fit together? Are they telling the same story, or are they making different claims about what's happening? And it turns out that the New Testament documents pass these tests with flying colors. Historians find the documents that we have in the New Testament to be incredibly reliable. In fact, they're our best sources for the life of Jesus. And so any scholar who's going to do work, historical work, on the life of Jesus is going to use these as their primary sources. So that's going to be the Gospels, that's going to be the epistles, so the different letters that were written, and things like that. They all date back incredibly early. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes here. They're all based on independent sources. They meet all these other criteria as well. They're incredibly reliable historically. So our methodology here is we are going to approach these documents in the same way that a historian would. And we're going to look at this and we're going to say, okay, given this, what should we think happened with Jesus? What can we know are facts about Jesus' life? And we're going to see that these facts actually give us really good reason to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. So let's start then with support for premise one and the three widely accepted historical facts. So the first fact is the discovery of Jesus's empty tomb. And the empty tomb is reported in six independent sources. And here I've got those for you. We've got Luke, John, Mark, Matthew, 1 Corinthians 15, and we've got some early sermons that are given in Acts 2. All of these point to the resurrection of Jesus and make claims about the resurrection of Jesus. And all of these sources date back to within two generations, 60 to 70 years of Jesus' death, and some actually to within 5 years of Jesus' death. And I'm going to explain that in just a second. Often when people look at evidence for the resurrection, they look at evidence for some past event, they think what matters is the amount of time that's passed between the evidence that they gathered and us today. And that's just not the case. What we actually really want is how much time has passed between the event that's said to have occurred and the reporting of it. That time frame is actually really crucial. That's what really matters here. And in fact, what we've seen is there's actually not enough time for legend to have developed. A scholar named A.N. Sherwin White, using the works of Herodotus, has shown that it takes much longer than two generations for there to even be any entry in of legend or mythological elements here. Far too short for what we have here. So one example I want to look at for how close this time period is we've got Jesus' burial is attested in the very old tradition, which is quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5. So let me give that to you here. Here's what Paul says. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. Now here's the crucial part coming up. What we have next is a stylized four-line formula that has non-Pauline characteristics. What that means is Paul clearly is getting this from somewhere else. And here's what he says. That Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, that is Peter, and then he appeared to the 12. And scholars have dated this old formula here to within 5 years of Jesus' death. And there's a whole lot to say about how it is that they got there and why they got there and all of that, and I'm going to spare you all of that. But again, I really encourage you, explore and look into some of this stuff. It's really, really fascinating. Second thing here is the burial story that we get in Mark is part of very old source material that Mark himself used in putting this together, and that also has been dated to within 7 years of Jesus' death. So we have here a very, very short time after Jesus' death that these things were recorded, and then we've got these gospels that use these prior sources. All right, third element here, and support for the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. The Gospels indicate that the empty tomb was discovered by women. Women were not highly regarded at this time. They were not considered credible witnesses. They had low social status. If you're making up this story, it's not women that you are going to have find the empty tomb. You're going to put men in there instead. And so the fact that that is included in there indicates that that really is what happened. And then finally, we have the response by the early Jewish authorities also indicates that the tomb was empty. Why? What was their response? Did they claim that Jesus' body had been moved or something like that? No. Their response was that the disciples had stolen the body. And what that indicates then is that the tomb was empty, right? Because if Jesus' body was still in the tomb, you don't need to say that his body was stolen. You can just say, actually, it didn't go anywhere, and it's just right here. So all of this gives us really good reason to believe that the tomb was discovered to be empty. Here's what Bart Ehrman, an atheist and a well-known New Testament scholar, says. Despite the enormous range of opinion, there are several points on which virtually all scholars of antiquity agree. Jesus was a Jewish man, known to be a preacher and a teacher, who was crucified, a Roman form of execution, in Jerusalem during the reign of the Roman Emperor Tiberius, when Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea. All right, let's move on now to the second point, the appearances of Jesus alive after his death. So the first point here is that Paul provides a list of eyewitnesses to the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15:5-8. And these are people who were still alive and could be asked about this event. Paul says that Jesus appeared to Peter, and that he appeared to the 12, and he appeared to a group of 500 disciples at once. He appeared to his younger brother James. He appeared to then all the other apostles. And then Paul says, and finally he appeared to me. Paul includes in here, he says, most of them who are still, let me go back. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Why does Paul include the remark, though some have fallen asleep? He seems to be indicating that most of the 500 are still alive, and you can actually go and talk with them about this and ask them about this. The second point I have up here is the appearance narratives in the Gospels provide multiple independent attestation of the appearances. And here I've got a list for you. I'm not going to go through them. You can read them yourselves, where it's referenced that Jesus appeared to Peter and who attests to that, and Jesus appeared to the 12 and who attests to that, and so on. So we see in several of the different Gospels, it's claimed that Jesus appeared to these different people here. This then takes us to Gerd Ludemann, who is also an atheist and a prominent New Testament scholar. And here's what he says. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. All right, third point here. The disciples' belief that Jesus rose from the dead. So here, Jesus' crucifixion would have indicated to his disciples that he was not, in fact, the Messiah. Given the beliefs that the Jews had at that time, they would never, ever have concluded from Jesus' death that he, in fact, was the Messiah. And I want to kind of unpack some beliefs that the ancient Jews had and why it would be so unlikely that they would ever come to the conclusion that Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah. So, as Jews, they would have had the following beliefs. And the first one is that the Messiah is victorious, so a victorious Messiah. That is, the Messiah would be a triumphant figure who would subdue Israel's enemies and would establish the throne of David. They would have had no concept of a Messiah who would have suffered and died. In fact, N.T. Wright, the New Testament historian, puts it this way. If you are a first century Jew, and your favorite Messiah got himself killed, you had two options. Go home or find yourself a new Messiah. Right? Those were your options. Because the Messiah couldn't possibly be someone who was killed. That would show he wasn't, in fact, the Messiah. The second point here is they also held to a universal resurrection. It was a bodily resurrection that would happen at the end of time. They had no concept of a resurrection that would happen not only just to an individual, but that would happen in time before the end of all things. And so to think that Jesus would have risen from the dead as an individual before the end of time would just not have been a concept that they would have even thought of. And then third, they believe that those who are crucified are cursed. In fact, according to Jewish law, Jesus' execution as a criminal showed him to be a heretic. He was a man who was actually under a curse by God. And that meant then Jesus' death would have been evidence that the Jewish leaders were right. Because God wouldn't allow, they would have thought, the Messiah to be crucified. Crucifying him showed he was cursed and was actually not from God. That was Jewish understanding. And so, if you are a first century Jew in Palestine, you're not going to think that Jesus rose from the dead, that the Messiah rose from the dead. And yet, they suddenly and very sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead. Something incredibly dramatic must have happened in order to do that, to get them to believe this. James, who was the brother of Jesus, didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah while Jesus was alive. It was after Jesus died that he came to believe that. Many of you have brothers. I have some brothers. What would it take for you to believe your brother was the Lord? quite a bit, right? So something incredible must have happened to James in order for him to come to believe this. And the same thing goes for Paul, right? Paul was persecuting the early church. Something amazing must have happened to him to totally change his beliefs about these sorts of things. And it seems like the best explanation is going to be that Jesus actually rose from the dead. And in fact, here's a quote from N.T. Wright. He says, "As a historian, I cannot explain the rise of early Christianity unless Jesus rose again, leaving an empty tomb behind him." In fact, N.T. Wright, he gives an argument for the resurrection of Jesus, and his whole argument centers on this final point I'm making to you. He's got an 800-page book that goes through laying out the Jewish beliefs and how it's impossible for them to have believed Jesus would have risen from the dead as the Messiah, given their history and their culture and their beliefs. All right, so those are the facts that we've got here. We've got our three supporting facts. And now the question is, well, what is the best explanation here? And it seems to me that the best explanation is that Jesus was raised from the dead by God. We seem to have really good reason to think that. In fact, it's difficult to find another option that would really adequately handle the facts. And yet, that hasn't stopped people from trying. And I want to give you some examples here. So, alternatives to the resurrection. So one is going to be what's called the conspiracy or the theft hypothesis. And this claims that the disciples faked the resurrection. They stole the body of Jesus and lied about it after his after death appearances. That is, they made the whole thing up. All right, there's a couple of problems I want to raise for this. So here's the first. I just talked about this a second ago. Jews had no concept of a Messiah who would be executed and then rise from the dead. So first off, they wouldn't have thought to do something like this. And second, that wouldn't be persuasive to anybody else. Second problem here. The disciples actually seem to sincerely believe that Jesus was risen from the dead. In fact, so sincerely that nearly all of them died as martyrs. The only ones who didn't were Judas, who committed suicide, and John. They were all willing to die for this. Third problem here, the story would have been told differently if it had been fabricated. So for example, the story wouldn't have had women be the ones to find the empty tomb. And also, if you're one of the disciples and you're making this story up, you're not going to have it where, you know, the disciples, they all abandoned Jesus. Are you going to include that in your made-up story? No. Peter, one of the founders of Christianity, denied Jesus. You're not going to include that if this is made up. So there's a number of embarrassing details to them that are included in these stories, which give us really good reason to think that they're true. And so if you were making this up, you would tell it much differently. The fourth problem here is that it would be incredibly difficult to successfully pull off a conspiracy of this magnitude. It's incredibly unlikely to be able to successfully do this. In fact, I want to give you a quote from Charles Colson. He was convicted and imprisoned for the Watergate scandal. And I want to read to you what he says here. "My personal experience in the Watergate scandal convinces me of the historic proof of the resurrection. I was charged with being part of the conspiracy to cover up the Watergate break-in. What most Watergate buffs have failed to note, however, is that the conspiracy succeeded for less than 3 weeks." He says, think of it. The most powerful men around the president of the United States could not keep a lie for 3 weeks. and you'd have me believe that the 12 apostles, powerless, persecuted, exiled, many martyred, and their leader Peter crucified upside down, these common men gave their lives for a lie without ever breathing a word to the contrary? Impossible. People will die for something they believe to be true, but men will never die for something they know to be false. All right. Second option here is the apparent death or the swoon hypothesis. And this says, well, Jesus didn't really die. He actually revived in the tomb and somehow escaped and managed to convince his disciples that he had risen from the dead. All right, there's a number of problems with this here. So here's the first one. This is not medically possible. Roman executioners were experts at killing. And in fact, they ensured that those who were crucified actually died by thrusting a spear into their side, which is reported in the Gospels. It happened to Jesus. Second, this is not physically possible either. A man who's sealed inside of a tomb would not be able to move the stone to escape. And third, this story is wildly implausible. The appearance of a half-dead man who's in great need of medical attention is not going to make anybody think that he had risen from the dead, right? But rather that he had not, in fact, died, somehow survived. So the disciples wouldn't have believed that Jesus actually rose from the dead. All right. C, the displaced body hypothesis. Jesus' body was moved and his followers just didn't know it. The idea here is that Joseph of Arimathea had placed Jesus' body in his tomb temporarily since it was so late, and then later on moved the body, and yet the disciples weren't aware. In fact, he moved Jesus' body to a criminal's graveyard. All right, there's several problems with this as well. Problem one, Jewish law prohibited moving a corpse after it was interred, except to the family tomb. He wouldn't have moved Jesus' body. Moreover, the criminal's graveyard was only 600 yards away from where Jesus was crucified. So there would have been no reason to put Jesus' body in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. You just put him in the criminal's graveyard. Second, since Joseph and his servants would have known where Jesus was buried, right, they could have easily corrected the disciples' mistake. Right, they say, oh my goodness, the tomb is empty. Jesus must have risen from the dead. And Joseph of Arimathea would have said, oh no, I just moved him over here. Here's where he is. Third, the hypothesis says nothing about the post-mortem appearances of Jesus. And it doesn't explain the disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection. So we're going to need something more to explain, well, why did they actually come to believe this? And how do we account for these appearances of Jesus? And finally, number four, the earliest Jewish Christian disputes were not over the location of Jesus' grave or the identity of the corpse, but why the tomb was empty. Right? If it had been a matter of Jesus having been moved, what the Jews would have said would have been something quite different here. All right, last hypothesis we're going to consider here. This is the hallucination hypothesis. And what this says is, the disciples didn't really see Jesus. They were all hallucinating. It never actually happened. All right, a couple problems with this. So problem number one, hallucination doesn't explain the diversity of the appearances. Right? It's unlikely that so many different people in different places would all have the exact same hallucination. Very unlikely. Second, hallucinations would have led the disciples to believe that Jesus had been transported to heaven, not that he had risen from the dead. N.T. Wright points out that, hey, you know, at this time, they actually believed in things like ghosts or visions or having hallucinations, except their explanation for those things was that this was of someone who was dead and was actually in heaven, and they were having a vision of this person who was in heaven already. And so if they had these experiences, their explanation wouldn't have been Jesus rose from the dead. It would have been, oh, Jesus is in heaven, and I'm getting a vision of him from him being in heaven. Third problem, The hypothesis says nothing about the empty tomb. Why is the tomb empty? And so this is going to have to be combined with some hypothesis about the empty tomb. All right. Well, we have come to the end of this argument here. What I want to do is I want to show you a short video that summarizes some of this, and then we'll wrap up for the evening here.
Why was Jesus of Nazareth crucified? Because he made outrageous claims about himself. He claimed to be the one and only Son of God. Why would anyone take his claim seriously? Well, that all depends. If Jesus actually rose from the dead, then his claim to be God's unique Son carries considerable weight. On the other hand, if the resurrection never actually happened, then Jesus may be safely dismissed as just another interesting but tragic historical figure. Did Jesus rise from the dead? As we explore this question, we need to address two further questions. What are the facts that require explanation? And which explanation best accounts for these facts? There are three main facts that need to be explained. The discovery of Jesus' empty tomb, the appearances of Jesus alive after his death, and the disciples' belief that Jesus rose from the dead. Let's examine each of these. Fact number one. The discovery that Jesus' tomb was empty is reported in no less than six independent sources, and some of these are among the earliest materials to be found in the New Testament. This is important because when an event is recorded by two or more unconnected sources, historians' confidence that the event actually happened increases, and the earlier these sources are dated, the higher their confidence. Moreover, the Gospels indicate that it was women who first discovered that Jesus' body was missing. This is likely historical because in that culture, a woman's testimony was considered next to worthless. A later legend or fabrication would have had men make this discovery. Our confidence in the empty tomb is further increased by the response of the Jewish authorities. When they heard the report that the tomb was found empty, they said that Jesus' followers had stolen his body, thereby admitting that Jesus' tomb was, in fact, empty. Most scholars, by far, hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb. Fact number two, the appearances of Jesus alive after his death. In one of the earliest letters in the New Testament, Paul provides a list of witnesses to Jesus' resurrection appearances. He appeared to Peter, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Finally, he appeared also to me. Furthermore, various resurrection appearances of Jesus are independently confirmed by the gospel accounts. On the basis of Paul's testimony alone, virtually all historical scholars agree that various individuals and groups experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. Fact number three, the disciples' belief in the resurrection. After Jesus' crucifixion, his followers were devastated, demoralized, and hiding in fear for their lives. As Jews, they had no concept of a Messiah who would be executed by his enemies, much less come back to life. The only resurrection Jews believed in was a universal event on Judgment Day after the end of the world, not an individual event within history. Moreover, in Jewish law, Jesus' crucifixion as a criminal meant that he was literally under God's curse. Yet somehow, despite all of this, the disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead. They were so completely convinced that, when threatened with death, not one of them recanted. Even the Pharisee Paul, who persecuted Christians, suddenly became a Christian himself, as did Jesus' skeptical younger brother, James. Some sort of powerful, transformative experience is required to generate the sort of movement earliest Christianity was. That is why, as an historian, I cannot explain the rise of early Christianity unless Jesus rose again, leaving an empty tomb behind him. These three firmly established facts cry out for an adequate explanation. How do you make sense of them? Down through history, various naturalistic explanations have been offered to explain away these facts. The conspiracy hypothesis, the apparent death hypothesis, the hallucination hypothesis, and so on. All of these have been nearly universally rejected by contemporary scholarship. The simple fact is that there is just no plausible naturalistic explanation of these three facts. The explanation given by the original eyewitnesses is that God raised Jesus from the dead. If it's even possible that God exists, then that explanation cannot be ruled out. For a God who is able to create the entire universe, the odd resurrection would be child's play. An empty tomb, Jesus' appearances alive after his death, and a group of dejected followers suddenly transformed by a radical new belief in a risen Messiah. These are independently established historical facts. How do you explain them?
Okay, we are running out of time here, so I'm going to go ahead and bring things to a close. So here's the argument. What have we shown over this three-part series here? Well, we've shown that there exists a being that is spaceless, timeless, uncaused, immensely powerful, an immaterial mind who intentionally designed the universe, is morally good, and is in fact the very definition of goodness itself. We've seen that the problem of evil, which I think is the strongest argument against the existence of God, the problem of evil fails. And we've seen that we've got really great reason to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I want to end things with this series with saying, I don't know all of you here, and I don't know where you are at in your relationship with God, but if you've never given your life to Jesus, I would love for you to come talk with me or talk with Jed or talk with Sammy or any other adult or person who's here. If someone brought you, we would love to talk with you and share the gospel with you, the great hope that we have. I want to end with this verse here. It's Colossians 1, 28 through 29. I really hope you've enjoyed this series. I really hope it's increased your faith. But I really hope it's encouraged you to share the gospel with others. And here's what Paul says. Him we proclaim, warning everyone and teaching everyone with all wisdom, that we may present everyone mature in Christ. For this I toil, Paul says, struggling with all his energy that he powerfully works within me. I pray that this helps you proclaim Christ. Thank you so much for coming out and for being great listeners.